Call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It's 1:31. We've got Senator Olson, Senator Dyson, Senator Wilkowski, Chairman Coghill. Expect to see Senator McGuire here any moment. The schedule for today, in my best planning effort, is to have Senate Bill 108 come up for introduction today, and then Senate Bill 171 come up for introduction today. Senate Bill 108 is Senator Dyson's access to criminal records. 171 is multidisciplinary teams that I have put in. And if we can get that done by 2 o'clock or before, I would appreciate that. I wanted to leave the remainder of the hour for Senate Joint Resolution 21, which is the Judicial Council one that I think this is the fourth meeting probably on that one, third or fourth. And I would like to get to the public testimony. And I know the Judicial Council has yet to testify. I've got some people calling in to testify. I want to have ample time for debate on committee. So with that, we have Senate Bill number 108. Senator Dyson, do you want to introduce it? How do you want to move forward on this?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, and then I'll have my Chief of Staff, Chuck Kopp, can straighten out everything I said wrong and give you the details you need. So we have been working with on criminal justice issues for several years, and one of the issues that keeps coming up, and that is the collateral consequences that lead from accusations, arrests, and so on, and convictions, and it very negatively affects reentry. And our state has more barriers to reentry than I think almost any state in union. And so what this bill does, it says if you've been arrested but it never went to trial because it was dismissed, or you were tried and it was acquitted, or there was no charges filed, after 90 days that posting on court view goes away. Those records are still available at court to attorneys and police department people, but they're not out there for the public. And what has happened is when an employer or a landlord is looking at records for somebody that's applying for a job or housing, they go to court view, they find an old arrest record, then that causes them to at least have some negative feelings and some reason of concern. Those of us that live in the Anchorage area remember a case here a couple of months ago. Young mother, I think she had kids in the car, was pulled over by an officer that thought she was driving under their influence, and hauled her off to station house, I think, and she blew a 0-0, and later there was no press charges. Was dismissed. Her record is up on court view. She was arrested for a DUI. And we've heard from innumerable people who have suffered from the records that are there that weren't substantiated by a court action. So what we're doing here is getting those things off court view if there's been no, if they've not been indicted, charges pressed, they were acquitted, or the charges were dismissed. So, and the history of the last couple of years, as I've worked on a number of these issues, I've literally begged the last two attorney generals and the Department of Law to take on the task of all the things that need to be updated in our criminal justice system, in the code, and so on. And at least on this issue, I've not seen them come forward. You probably have seen it's in your packet from the Alaska Justice Forum, and it talks about this very issue and the importance of getting it straight. I also might add on a lighter note, I have a ne'er-do-well acquaintance who a judge looked over the edge of the bench and said, Mr. X, you have the honor of being the 118th person this woman has filed a restraining order on. I suspect that's close to being a record, and I suspect that at least a few of those were not. And I'm told, and this is totally anecdotal, that in certainly for many divorce lawyers, once the papers are filed, it's often, one of them told me, I always advise my client to run to the court and get a domestic restraining order or file some other charge. And he said, I would feel irresponsible to my client if I didn't give my client every tool. Anyways, that's anecdotal. I suspect there's some truth to it. Mr. Kopp will explain further about our bill.
All right. For the record, Senator McGuire has joined us. Thank you, Senator. Mr. Kopp, put yourself on the record and give us testimony on Senate Bill 108.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Genesis of Senate Bill 108 came from a collateral consequences of conviction working committee that was established over this last year, and the committee looked at arrest, not just conviction, realizing there are so many consequences associated with an arrest, whether the person was acquitted, whether the charge was dismissed outright, or whether the charges were a combination of dismissal and acquittal, that they still had to carry that around with them indefinitely under the current rules for posting information publicly. So what Senate Bill 108 does is it seeks to strengthen the privacy and liberty interests of persons by looking at the term confidential, which is defined in Administrative Rule of Court 37.5, looking at that, using that definition of confidential, and then applying it to dismissed and acquitted charges or combinations thereof. So specifically what the bill does, Mr. Chairman, is it would make court records confidential in a criminal case if 90 days have elapsed from the date of acquittal or dismissal and the person was acquitted of all charges filed in the case, to all criminal charges against the person have been dismissed, or three, the person was acquitted of some of the charges in the case and the remaining charges were dismissed. It does not pose any restriction on police or prosecution ability to access those records and the charging documents. It does not remove any information in the National Crime or the Alaska Public Safety Information Network, ABSIN database, and it would not render any information in the public domain confidential. CourtView, which is the Alaska Trial Court's online publicly accessible database, does provide exceptional access for persons that are seeking information on criminal and civil cases and the nature of charges that are filed against those persons and the final outcome of the litigation. The information is indefinitely displayed, and it will show that regardless of whether or not there was a conviction of record. The public posting of the person's name and the charge has had significant deleterious effects on employment prospects, ability to find housing, and other professional and personal opportunities for these people. We believe that by very definition, a person is not a criminal if they are acquitted at trial or if their case is dismissed by the prosecution and not proved in a timely manner. This is our American maxim of jurisprudence that we are to be considered innocent unless proven guilty, and we feel this bill strengthens that maximum. There are only three brief sections, Mr. Chairman. Quickly, Section 1 amends AS 2235 by adding a new section in 030 that deals with records concerning criminal cases resulting in acquittal or dismissal being considered confidential. This section of the bill establishes that a court record of a criminal case is confidential if 90 days have elapsed from the date of acquittal or dismissal, and one, the person was acquitted of all charges filed in the case, two, all charges against the person have been dismissed, or three, the person was acquitted of some of the charges in the case and the remaining charges were dismissed. Section 2 adds a new section to AS 2235, which establishes the applicability of the Act to criminal charges concluded on or after the effective date of the Act by dismissal or by acquittal of the defendant. And then Section 3 is when the Act takes effect. That is the introduction.
Thank you, Mr. Kopp. Is there any questions? First of all, Senator Wilkowski and Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kopp. On appeals, and I don't know if you're able to do this or maybe someone from law, but how would this work in the case of an appeal? Have you given that any thought?
Sure. In a case that's appealed is still an ongoing case, so you'd be on court view, whoever would be on court view the entire time that case was still.
So case is dismissed, and then the prosecution decides to file an appeal?
Sure, if it's done within 90 days. So that's why we give the whole idea is having a time limit, so it's not indefinite, that it would be open and no action being taken by the state.
But the whole time, Mr. Could. If it's sometimes these appeals can take a year or two, the whole time case is dismissed, but the appeal process may drag on for a year or two. It would still stay on online.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Rakowski, you are correct.
Thank you,
Senator.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Kopp. You, and I guess it's also for Senator Dyson. You're familiar with the case of Nancy Means, because our offices have been working on behalf of justice for her. This is the young woman, 20 years of age, at the time she was only 18, who was had a disabled van on Black Friday. She was out shopping with her 17-year-old friends, and their car became disabled. She pulled over to the side of the road and was looking for help, and a police officer stopped her. And rather than assisting her, ended up asking a series of questions. She ended up answering most of them. Then when they became invasive, she refused to answer any further questions and asserted her constitutional rights. And at that moment in time, the police officer decided to administer a walking test, if you will, and arrest her under suspicion of DUI. Nancy had never drank in her life, wasn't a drinker. Took her back to the station. She blew a 0.00. In that instance, I want to know if this would apply to her case, because what Nancy is facing is that there is a record out there that is very bizarre, in that it is a record that says that she was arrested on suspicion of a DUI. And of course, you know, there couldn't have been. I mean, Nancy doesn't drink, didn't have a smell of breath of alcohol in her breath because she doesn't drink and wasn't drinking, wasn't erratic driving, was a young woman whose car had been disabled, all these kinds of things. She's been fighting to get this expunged because Nancy wants to go on to graduate school and other things, but this sits out there. So that's not really an acquittal, and it's not really a dismissal. And that's the language of the bill. So how does that apply to Nancy?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, that's a very good question. I do believe the bill does apply to Nancy. I believe that dismissals would include those charges that are brought before the court, and the DA would decline to follow through and issue an indictment. I know that Ms. Means, Nancy Means General Court Counsel, is here.
Okay.
But dismissals include everything from the DA dismissing a file charge that they filed, and I also believe that includes the initial arrest by declining to follow through and issue an indictment on behalf of the state. But I don't want to speak for the court.
Okay. Well, if I might, through the chair, Mr. Kopp, I'd like to get that on the record, because if it's not, I would like to have those kinds of cases covered. And I wasn't, you know, even aware of that kind of a circumstance until her family came to me and we started talking about it. And you just kind of think about those Alaskans out there. There are great, great police officers out there. I want to say that, obviously. But in these circumstances where you have a young Alaskan who is falsely accused of something and later, of course, exonerated by all facts, but yet they've got this arrest sitting out there that is alleging a horrible set of circumstances. You know, to get into law school, you can, and Senator Wilkowski will tell you, you can't even have more than a couple parking tickets, more or less something out there that would have said you were ever arrested having anything to do with alcohol, a suspicion of alcohol. So this is a horrible set of circumstances, and so I just want to be clear that that case is covered.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, this, of course, this bill was not certainly about that case or any case, but I do believe that it applies. And since introduction of this, we have been inundated with people in all walks of life that this bill would apply to, and that story you'll find in testimony is not uncommon.
Senator Dyson.
Are you done or with us, or is Bob ready to close it?
Yeah, I think the question's good, and I'd hope that you'd bring those answers back when we bring it back up for discussion. Senator Dyson.
Just let me say in closing, on a suite of things we've been doing on our revisions of the criminal justice system and smart justice and so on, we've had lots of conversations on virtually every one of them with the Department of Law. Sometimes we agree to disagree, but it's been a pretty darn good reciprocal relationship. Lately, that has deteriorated a bit, and I indeed hope that if Department of Law has any issues with this, that we'll get a chance to visit with them the next few days before we get surprised by their testimony here in committee.
Senator Bilkoski.
I've heard from many constituents over the years who have had this exact problem. And as an attorney, I've dealt with people who've had this exact problem. And they went through the process, and they were completely exonerated, and yet it still sticks on their record.
Yeah.
So I thank you for bringing this up. I think it's an important bill. I think I want to hear the other side. I want to hear what, you know, the other side has to say, if there is another side. I suspect there is, but I think it's a good discussion that we need to have because it's impacting a lot of Alaskans in an adverse way.
I wanted the committee to get the introduction to it today and get the questions out on the table. Certainly the Department of Law, the court system, will ask them to speak to it as far as process and how it affect various different people. So even those who apply for public safety jobs in Alaska, if there's been a false arrest, if you will, or a charge that didn't stick, it's my understanding too that DMV can take a license on an administrative hearing based on an arrest and not necessarily on a conviction. So those kind of things, it makes it for a serious question. So I sure appreciate you bringing it forward.
Thank you.
And with that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to hold Senate Bill 108 over, and I would ask that the sponsor of the bill make sure that we have the range of testimony for those questions, and then I'll ask the Department of Law to come on up, all right? Thank you very much. At this point, what I want to do also is introduce the Bill 171 that it's really something that was done by request. It's one of the bills that I've introduced that is kind of in the target area that I work with, and that is children's justice. So I've tried to work, you know, pretty thoroughly. This has to do with decision-making. Multidisciplinary teams right now only can reside in OCS, and I'll have Reneva explain the bill. And Senator Kelly's in the room with us, and so he's going to be waiting for us to get to his bill. But I wanted the introduction to this, so Reneva, go ahead and put yourself on the record, and I think we'll have Jan also.
Reneva Moss, staff to Senator Coghill. This piece of legislation was brought to us by the Alaska Children's Justice Task Force, and I have with me the chairman of that task force, Jan Rutherdale. Basically, what this does is it will still stay within the administration of OCS. However, what it wants to do is put on record what is already practice, and that is there are cases that benefit from multiple disciplinary child protection teams that aren't necessarily being handled by OCS. An example would be one parent finds out that the child has been sexually abused by the other parent. The parent calls the police, removes the child from access from the other parent, and the child is safe. So OCS isn't involved, but there has been a child abuse issue. Child protection is needed. Multidisciplinary protection team is put together. And for those who don't know what these teams do, they're a group of professionals involved in a case like this that work together to reduce potential trauma and to improve the services to the families. So very briefly, Section 1 of the bill creates the law enforcement or the criminal aspect of it so that it's not only just OCS, but it's also when there's a child protection issue, there can be a multidisciplinary team. Number two just explains the makeup of the team. You have the professionals that are always involved in a multidisciplinary team, but you're also adding people that would benefit the family if they were involved. The new language that's added.
Just for what it's worth, to the members of the committee, and my apologies, but there is a U draft that we'll be looking at. It's a committee substitute that actually spelled out some things that weren't in the previous bill. My apologies to you, Reneva, but
okay.
Since you were going to run down through the bill, I figured they better know which one you're talking about. So it's the U version, dated 2/20/14. Do you have it, committee members? All right. Please proceed.
Okay. What we've changed here is before there had to be someone who was familiar with ICWA. Now we actually have a representative of an Indian tribe if there is an ICWA case involved. And then we've also added someone from Division of Juvenile Justice. Section 3 just qualifies that a multidisciplinary team can conduct business without some of the mandatory members being present. For instance, OCS, if they're not involved, they wouldn't be present. It also clarifies that members of these teams will have access to confidential records in child protection cases, and it there are regulations that specifically outline what those confidential records are, and that the regulation is in your packet. Section 4 just says that these teams will now start meeting monthly, and Section 5 just emphasizes that one of the purposes of a multidisciplinary team is to avoid duplicative interviews with children to reduce the trauma.
And to be fair, the legislature has helped put the children's advocacy centers in, which is the place where you're going to see these multidisciplinary teams work. So you'll have the police interviewing at the same time with doctors. At the same time, you'll have public defenders, people who are interested in the well-being of that child. So our purpose here was to see that the child is not re-traumatized, and this team is probably the best way of moving forward on that.
Correct. And number 6 is just to clarify that it's not just OCS that can investigate, that there are other agencies that deal with child protection. And I just wanted to put on the record that these multidisciplinary teams were established by statute in 1998 in House Bill 375, which is the piece of legislation that then private citizen John Coghill sat in the LIO for 2 days waiting to testify on that piece of legislation, and I think it put the fire in his belly to run for office.
Well, actually, since you mentioned it, I did wait, and as you'll see today, we'll have professional people testifying. I took off work. It cost me almost $200 to sit there and wait to testify, and I never did get to testify. Made me so mad that I did run for office.
And
that's one of the reasons why on this committee I will try to always let the public testify as soon as we possibly can.
I just had Jan come in case I missed anything. So if I missed anything, Jan?
Ms. Weatherdale, put yourself on the record and any testimony at this point.
Sure. My name is Jan Weatherdale, and I'm the chair of the Children's Justice Act Task Force, as Reneva said. I guess the only clarification is just to there's really two functions of the MDTs. One is an investigatory function. So you might want to investigate children's cases, you know, OCS generated cases, like for example the example she gave. But let's say you didn't have a protective parent, so it was a child protection issue. And then you also may have a criminal prosecution coming in, and that's, in her example, if there was a protective parent, then you wouldn't have OCS involved. Other times, both of them are involved because it may be prosecuted criminally, but also prosecuted through the OCS system, or, you know, the case would go through the OCS system. So this just clarifies that in those cases where OCS is not involved, that that law enforcement can do an investigation and not have and OCS doesn't have to be involved, so the protections of the statute would still apply in that situation. And then the second, there's sort of the other function of MDT is sometimes it reviews ongoing OCS child protection matters. So it's ones that are, let's say OCS has already filed a petition, it's working its way through court, and maybe they need the assistance of a multidisciplinary team, and so they refer the case, and or maybe there's other people on the MDT that is concerned about how the case is progressing or whatever, and they maybe refer the case to the MDT. So I just wanted to point out that there's two functions. One is an investigatory function, and then the other is a more ongoing of OCS cases function.
It's one of those teams, though, that is able to kind of break through some of the silo walls that you have in a variety of different departments who have all have authority to deal with that young child. Mm-hmm. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I worked really hard on this whole issue, and now we have child advocacy centers in how many cities?
Oh, it seems like there's about 12 of them.
Yeah.
10 to 12.
Absolutely delighted, but also the genius of it is that it greatly reduces the impact on the child. They only have to answer these questions. Very child-friendly. And the result has been much better cases going forward. The police can get the forensic information they need, and they are able to get really good cases. And it's just one of the success stories we've had. The fact that they are so busy and there are so many of them is a great tragedy. And when we were doing that piece, I just never thought about this piece. Mm-hmm. So thanks for plugging a little hole that we missed.
Well, it actually came from this particular group, so thanks to the chairman of the Children's Justice Working Group. Is that what it's called? Did I get that
Children's
wrong?
Children's Justice Act Task Force.
Act Task Force. Is there any other questions? Now, my intention is to go ahead and have a couple of different departments come and give you further testimony on this. There are probably other questions we can bring up, but my intention at this point, why don't I just make a motion to have version U as the bill before us. Senator Dyson, why don't you go ahead and just make a motion?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the new version of, is that a committee substitute? Or a
substitute? It's a CS.
A committee substitute for SB 171 U version be adopted as our working document.
Any objections? So without objection, this will be the next version in front of us so that you all have an idea of what we're going to work off of. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Reneva. Thank you, Jan. And thank you, committee. Obviously, that's going to be something that we're going to there's a couple of pieces on this to work on. So those two bills will be coming up. My intention is to on Wednesday to bring the multidisciplinary child protection up. On Wednesday, we're also going to bring Senator Olson has Senate Bill 136 to bring up. And 108, right? I think Senator Dyson.
Roger.
So with that, what I'd like to do at this point is we get Senate Joint Resolution number 21. What I'd like to do is we have several people to testify. Susan DiPietro is the Alaska Judicial Council Executive Director. I don't want to reassign any new tasks. I wanted to leave this last hour for us to get the last testimony on this, some debate in committee. My intention is to bring it up for a vote unless we just run out of time, and it looks like time-wise we're working pretty good, so I appreciate that. So if I can get Suzanne come on up and give us your testimony. Senator Kelly, my commitment is to let you have the last say, and so as we move forward here. All right.
Good afternoon.
Put yourself on the record. Thank you.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Chairman Coghill and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I am Suzanne DiPietro. I am the new executive director of the Alaska Judicial Council. This is my first month in the job, and I'm thrilled to be here to be able to talk to you about what the Judicial Council does. I want to talk just a little bit about our responsibilities. So the Judicial Council is involved in three areas of government in Article 4 of the Constitution and statutes. We screen applicants for judgeships based on their qualifications and send at least two names to the governor for appointment. We then evaluate the performance of sitting judges and make information available to the voters about the performance of those judges so that the voters can vote on them in retention elections. And that's a very important piece. Those two pieces, the selection and the retention, go together. They're part of the merit selection system that our founders designed for us in the Constitution. The third responsibility that we have in Article 4, Section 9 of the Constitution is often overlooked, but it's one of the responsibilities that I'm very excited about, and that is the responsibility to conduct studies to improve the administration of justice. And we've done numerous studies over the years, including studies of the effectiveness of therapeutic courts. We've examined the child protection case processing process through the court system. We've studied domestic violence protective orders, who files them, how many there are, whether they're effective or not. And we've studied criminal sentencing, recidivism, and outcomes in felony case processing. And all of that, we hope, is of assistance to policymakers such as yourselves who have questions about how things are working and whether things could be improved. I also wanted to talk just briefly about the members of the Judicial Council. They serve staggered six-year terms. Right now, we have a very strong council, as we usually do. We have Ken Kreitzer from Juneau. And actually, there's a packet of information that I provided you in the first page has some information about the members of the Judicial Council on it. I'm not going to read all that, but just to let you know, we have Kathleen Tompkins-Miller from Fairbanks. And we have Amy Aravic from Fairbanks, Julie Willoughby from Juneau, and Kevin Fitzgerald from Anchorage. His term just ended, and he will be replaced by Jim Torgerson from Anchorage. And then our newest member is Dave Parker from Wasilla. And two of the people who've just been on the council, Kevin Fitzgerald and Julie Willoughby, are second-generation Alaskans. So we tend to have incredibly qualified and members of the council and people who are deeply rooted in the community. So I wanted to talk in a little bit more detail about the merit selection and retention process. And I know that the testimony so far to this committee has focused really on the merit selection process, but I have to remind myself that we can't talk about merit selection without also talking about retention. The idea is that you have, and this was the ideas of the founders when they wrote this into the Constitution, the idea is that you have a group of six citizens chaired by the Chief Justice who screen applicants, send their names to the governor who makes the appointment, and then we involve the people through their popular vote directly in the retention process so that every judge who is selected must stand for retention, and just an up and down vote by the people. And that balance was very important to the founders, and we can't really talk about one without the other, because the geniuses really included really a role for all parts of government, the executive, the legislative, the legal profession, and also the public directly. So it's really a very good process, and as I think others have mentioned, it is considered the gold standard in the nation for the way to select judges. So I want to tell you a little bit about the merit selection system, the way it's implemented by the Judicial Council. So when there's a judicial vacancy, the council is notified of that, sends out a press release and a notice to every member of the Alaska Bar Association, letting them know that there's going to be a vacancy and inviting them to apply. We then give them about a month to fill out an application, and it's a good thing we do, because it probably takes about a month to compile all the information that goes into this application, which is lengthy. We want them to tell us every single employer, legal and non-legal, that they've ever had, and contact information, their legal and non-legal education, their community service, bar service, how many trials they've had over the last 5 years, the names of the judges and other attorneys who worked with them and against them in those trials, and their contact information, and we contact those people and ask for an assessment, their candid assessment of how the candidate did. We want to know about their practice. Was it criminal or civil? The names of references, so we ask them for professional references, three, and then we ask them for two character references, and these are just people in the community who can talk about their character, not necessarily their legal ability. We investigate confidential information. Were there any grievances filed against these attorneys with the Bar Association, or if the candidate is a judge already, whether there's been any discipline filed against the judge with the Judicial Conduct Commission, any criminal charges, speeding tickets, any kind of moving violations, and those do come up. We check for civil lawsuits. We check credit reports. We check criminal history. We do an exhaustive investigation. We also solicit comments from the public, and we do this continuously throughout the process, and it's a very important part of our process, and actually one that we're very proud of and one that we're a little bit different than other selection nomination commissions in the country because we have such a robust public component to our process. We then send out a survey to members of the bar, asking them, we do it electronically, but they can also have paper if they want, asking them to give their opinion based on direct professional experience about the person, about the applicants. And we're asking them about specific areas that are known to correlate to being a good judge, and those are legal ability, temperament, integrity, fairness, and suitability of experience. Results of that survey are public. And again, that's a little bit different than other places that keep these things a little bit more under wraps. But we think it's important to get that information out to the public, and we do. I want to say a word about the bar survey. Attorneys and judges have an ethical obligation explicitly set out in our code of conduct that they may not say a false thing about an applicant for a judicial vacancy. And that's Rule 8. It's very explicit. And we remind them of that, actually. I have even a draft bar survey here right on the front page. We say, remember, Rule 8.2, a lawyer shall not make a statement that the lawyer knows to be false or with reckless disregard as to its truth or falsity concerning the qualifications or integrity of a candidate for appointment to judicial office. And we take this very seriously, and we remind them repeatedly during the process that they need to be honest. And that is... And to violate that would be an offense that could result in discipline. When the bar survey results come back, we publish them. We then set a meeting date, and we always hold the meeting in the place where the vacancy is located. So, for example, Judge Jeffrey has announced his retirement. We're going to be going to Barrow at the end of September. And we always go to the place of the vacancy. Why do we do that? We do it for one really important reason, which is we want to hear from the people in that location what they think their judge should be like. And so we always have a public hearing. We also, in the smaller rural communities, we can often get on the radio or on the scanner, and we can put something up in the post office to get people to participate in the public hearing. That's not quite as effective sometimes in larger communities, but we're always there in the community asking the people to tell us what they think about the candidates or about what qualities they think the Judicial Council members should take into account when choosing a judge for their community. And again, that's an extremely important part of our process and one that is not necessarily replicated in other nominating commissions. We send all this information that we've gathered to the council members before the meeting. It's usually in excess of 100 pages per applicant. Everyone gets that in advance. They have that. We used to print it out. We don't do that anymore, but when we used to print it out, it would literally be stacks, you know, 6, 8, 10 inches thick. It's a lot of information, and the council members have told me that they'll often spend as much time preparing for the interview as they do in the actual interview process. And the interview process is we schedule about 45 minutes for each person. Sometimes they go longer so that there can be a very good discussion. And those interviews, again, can be in public, open to the public, if the candidates request that. And, I mean, you have to, and that happens more than you might think. So, for example, for the Anchorage Superior Court vacancy that's coming up, 3 of the 6 applicants have said that they'd like their interviews to be open to the public. And that's a pretty interesting thing. It's like having your job interview open to the public. Mm-hmm. So we strive for openness and public involvement in every way that we can. After the interviews, the council members are discuss. Each council member is called upon to discuss their impressions of each candidate, and the process is. I want to try to describe the process. It's very thorough. It's very deliberative, and it's very carefully engineered so that every council member is not only offered the opportunity to speak, but is called on to speak, to give their views. And there's a lot of give and take, and they go around the table very, very deliberatively, one, then the next, then the next. And the process is extremely collegial, and there's a lot of give and take, a lot of good exchange of views, and a very collegial and thorough process. So I also wanted to, so that's, I guess I would say, if there's any questions about the process, that was probably a little bit tedious, but I thought it was important to get on the record everything that we, or almost everything that we go through when we're handling a judicial selection.
Probably for, well, yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Mr. Chair, in order to be a judge in Alaska, is it required that you are an attorney?
You can be a magistrate judge. You do not need to be an attorney to be a magistrate judge.
Are most Superior Court and Supreme Court judges or justices attorneys?
To be a Supreme Court, a Superior Court, or a District Court judge, you must be an attorney, yes.
And then,
Senator Wilkowski,
could you follow up? So there's bar survey results where the attorneys evaluate those who are up for nomination. And is there any sort of correlation between the higher scores and those that are ultimately nominated?
Yes, there is a correlation between higher bar survey scores and the likelihood of being nominated. So that scores that are above 3.5 and above, you are statistically more likely to be nominated.
If I could,
Senator Wilkowski,
have you done any sort of analysis to determine whether or not those who have higher survey ratings ultimately have higher performance evaluation ratings when they go up for retention?
Through the chair, yes, it's interesting that we have looked at that. And in fact, it's true that the higher bar survey scores during the selection process do correlate to higher scores in the judicial evaluation process.
Okay.
So the under that selection criteria, the way I understand it, the survey is confidential.
Yes.
And it's voluntary, so it's not self-selecting, but people may or may not participate, the way I understand it?
Yes, that is true.
All right.
It's not mandatory to complete the survey.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any sort of correlation between writing samples and higher retention scores?
Oh, that's it. Actually, yes, through the chair, it is very interesting. So we study our process because we want to always improve our process, and we've actually published a report with a lot of this information. And yes, as it turns out, having a writing sample that is scored as excellent is more closely correlated with higher performance on retention than people who had lower writing scores.
And what are those scores based on?
They're based on grammar, syntax, clarity of ideas, conciseness, quality of legal analysis. We have a staff person. Actually, we have the same staff person who's been doing that, I think, for decades. So we have.
But could it be akin to English teachers grading English?
Yes, very much so.
All right.
Yeah.
And for those who may not be receive scores, is there a curve that they could complain about? One of the questions that we keep asking ourselves, is it kind of elitist in that only certain people get scored and other people are left behind?
Mm-hmm.
So tell me how that thorough that process is.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. It's a good question. And the staff member who gives the assessment of the writing sample gives that assessment, but the council members have the writing sample themselves.
Okay.
So they can read it, and I think we tell them to limit it to 20 pages. So they can read for themselves and whether they agree or disagree with the staff member's assessment.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
And so, what I'd like to do, I'd like for you to move along.
Okay.
If I can get other people to testify, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9 more people to go, and I'd like to have time to wrap up.
Okay. I will.
You've had 20 minutes or 15 minutes. So.
Okay. I will speed through. So, I did want to briefly talk about the work of the council, the outcomes that the council has. And again, in your packet, I gave you some materials. I just wanted to go very, very quickly through this sheet here that is an analysis of, it has some pie charts on it. It's an analysis of the Judicial Council's voting. The first thing that people don't necessarily know is that about 81% of the time, the Judicial Council is either unanimous or nearly unanimous in its selection votes. And the pie chart shows that. Also, you've heard this testimony before, but attorney-non-attorney vote splits are extremely rare. They've happened only 15 times out of 1,136 votes. That's less than 2% of all votes. Also, I'd like to tell the committee that the Chief Justice votes very rarely, only 6% of the time. When called on to vote, the Chief Justice usually forwards the name in question to the governor. That's 75% of the time the Chief Justice votes yes to forward the name to the governor. Also, another thing that often people don't know is that the council usually forwards more than two names to the governor. So in about 73% of all judicial selections, council members forward more than two names to the governor. And the instances when the council, not all, but many of the instances in which the council forwards fewer names occurs in vacancies in small rural areas where we may have only two applicants, and that does happen. The other thing I wanted to share with you is a chart that I included in your materials, and you heard some testimony about the fact that there have been 5 Chief Justice votes in the last 2 years, and that is true. But you have to, when I hear that, I wanted to ask myself, well, that's very interesting. It would matter to me to know whether that was 5 out of 5 votes or 5 out of 10,000 votes. It makes a difference, right? So I went back and looked because I wanted to know. And this chart shows that the top line here is very jagged. That's the total number of votes the council has taken over time, starting in 1984 and going all the way to the present. And you'll see that really sometimes we're very busy and sometimes we're not so busy. We've been getting more busy. And you will also see on this dashed line below that the Chief Justice votes pretty much stayed flat. So as a percentage of total votes, the Chief Justice votes are actually not varying that much. So you have to ask yourself, yes, there have been 5 in the last 2 years, but 5 out of how many? And the answer is 5 out of quite a lot. And actually in the past 2 years, the Chief Justice voting rate has been around 4%, which is less than the historical average of 6%. So I just wanted to give that for context. Now, I also wanted to talk just 2 more minutes about the bill, and I first want to say that this factual information I've been giving you is just information of the work that we do. The Judicial Council has not met to decide whether to take a position at all on SJR 21, and so I'm not here to support or to not support the legislation, but I think that for the record, we should remind ourselves about the Constitutional Convention and the founders and what their concerns were when they decided that we should have this merit selection system. And I went through the minutes of the Constitutional Convention, and these really aren't my words, but the words of the founders. So the theory is you have a select group. The lawyers know who are good, and they know who are bad. The laymen represent in substance the public. Another quote is, the whole theory of the Missouri plan is that in substance a select and professional group licensed by the state can best determine the qualifications of their brothers. The intent of the Missouri plan was in substance to give a predominance of the vote to professional men who knew the foibles, the defects, and the qualifications of their brothers. It is unquestionably true that in every trade and every profession, the men who know their brother careerists the best are the men engaged in the same type of occupation. So that was the theory. The theory is to have an equal balance of public members and lay members, and then let the public, then those names go to the governor, so there's an executive branch participation, and then the public participates directly in the vote. of whether to retain the judges or not. The last piece of information I'll give you is how other states do it. So I have information. There are about 38 other states that use judicial nominating commissions. And most of those states, 18, have an equal number of attorney and non-attorney members as Alaska does. A few states have more non-attorney members, as this SJR 21 would leave us with. But I just wanted to bring to your attention that those states typically have a restriction on the total number of members that can be the total number of people on the commission that can be a member of a particular political party. So, for example, I believe Arizona was cited to you as an example. So in Arizona, there are 10 non-attorney members, but only 5 of them can be of the same political party. There are 5 attorney members, and only 3 of the 5 can be of the same political party, and that is explicitly set out. That's not the way our founders decided to do it. They decided to go with a sort of an apolitical approach, but just so you know, there in other states that have imbalance, they do try to impose balance through other mechanisms, and so I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
And I think one of the focuses of this bill is to try to find maybe a better regional balance mm-hmm. with public members, and so, which I tend to agree with. Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thank you. Has anybody done the work to correlate the different, at least two different schemes, one of them with equal representation and so on, would you say 38 of them or something like that? Let's see, 12, the ones that don't correlate the crime rates and recidivism rates or cases overturned on appeal.
Through the chair, that's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. It would be a wonderful study to do, though.
I'm not sure anybody would agree that it's a great question and a great study or that anybody's willing to do it.
Well, I like research.
Because they haven't. But thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. And I'm going to move forward. If there's other questions, we'll have you come up. Between the Judicial Council and the court system, we have had an hour and a half of their testimony, and we have public members waiting to testify. So if you don't mind, I'd like to get to the other testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you, and greatly appreciate it. We do have Fritz Pettyjohn, who's in California, and he's a former state senator, and he's been hanging online for quite a while. I want to give him an opportunity to testify. So, Mr. Pettyjohn, are you there, and are you able to get your testimony up?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the opportunity. I am a practicing attorney. I've been a member of the Alaska Bar Association for 30 years and have participated in bar surveys and watched very closely the activities of the Alaska Judicial Council over that period of time. And quite frankly, I have never understood why the guild that I happen to belong to, it's called the Bar Association, why we are given this controlling, not just input, but control over a branch of government. It makes absolutely no sense to me. But let me tell you about these bar surveys. They're not a very good way to measure a merit, in my opinion. I have known very good lawyers who were prosecutors in the district attorney's office who were unable to get onto the bench because during these bar surveys, the criminal defense attorneys would unanimously rate them poorly if they were effective and aggressive prosecutors. So there are other factors that get involved, regardless of all the nice sentiments, about how all this works. In fact, even politics can play a role, unfortunately. And, I would just point out that the judicial system has a bias in favor of its own power. They of course, are able to make rules, and if those rules are procedural, it takes two-thirds of the legislative vote to overturn them. What's procedural and what's substantive? The lawyers decide. Also, in a case involving constitutional questions, well, if it's a constitutional question, the judges decide that. If it's not, then the legislature decides. Who decides if something's constitutional or not? The judges do. So there's a conflict of interest here between the judicial system and the other branches of government. And I know you have a lot of witnesses, and a lot of people want to put their two cents in, but You know, you don't have policemen elect the police chief. You don't have firemen elect the fire chief. And what is particularly interesting, I have been a resident of the state of California for 13 years. And for that entire 13-year period, as a non-resident of the state of Alaska, I'm a member of the Bar Association, so I get to vote on judicial counsel. And other members, actual citizens of Alaska, who are not lawyers, cannot vote. It's not a good system. It was designed with lawyers in mind. Lawyers have a role to play. We want legal expertise involved in evaluating potential candidates, of course. But they should not make the decisions. The decisions should be made by members of the public. This is a branch of government. We are a democratic system. Who decides? The people, not the lawyers. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pettyjohn. A question from Senator Olson for you.
Senator Pettyjohn, thank you very much for coming out and staying on the phone for a long period of time. The one question I do have for you, though, back in the 70s and 80s, when we were starting to see this trend that was going on, why didn't you, as part of the legislature, put something forth that was akin to this so that we don't have to deal with what's going on now that I see happening with the Judicial Council?
If I thought I could have gotten a two-thirds vote, I would have done it in a heartbeat, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate the testimony. So that was my biggest long-distance call. I'm going to go to Alexander O'Brenner, who is a retired Supreme Court justice. Are you still on the phone? Can you hear us all right?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yeah, please go ahead and give us your testimony. Put your name on the record, please.
My name is Alexander O'Brenner, B-R-Y-N-E-R. And I'm testifying here on my own behalf as a citizen and as an attorney. I have a lengthy background of service as an attorney and as a judge in Alaska. I first came to Alaska in 1969 to work for Justice George Boney, who was an early appointee and a fervent believer in judicial independence. And after listening and learning from Justice Boney, Chief and eventually Chief Justice Boney, I think I took that message to heart, and all of my experience in the state has led me to believe that we have really a flagship system of judicial selection here that can certainly be improved. But is based on a set of constitutional principles that our founders adopted very carefully, full well knowing what they're doing. And if there was any group of people who were not swayed by attorneys and arguably hoodwinked by attorneys, it's our constitutional founders. They were the best and the brightest available. They designed our Constitution and adopted its provisions full well knowing what they did, and without undue influence by any bar membership or any other group. Their whole purpose was to avoid continuing with a system of judicial selection and judicial enforcement that resulted in judges who were beholden to vested interests that did not reflect those in Alaska. That was the experience that they had as a territory, and their whole purpose in designing the independent system of selecting justice resulted from a desire to have independent judges who are not beholden to any group or to any particular vested interest. Over the course of that time, that system has worked well, and I agree with the testimony of people like Bill Gordon, who was one of the public members of the Judicial Council when I served for 3 years as chair of the Judicial Council as Chief Justice of the state. There is nothing constitutional broken that needs to be fixed. There are definitely improvements that can be made. There are strong improvements that have been made over the period of time. But to alter the basic foundations, constitutional foundations of our current selection system really be impractical and involve mischief. The system, as adopted by our founders, includes a number of critical aspects. The first are that the council created the Judicial Council as an independent entity. It's not an entity that exists within the control of the legislature, within the control of the court system, or within the control of the executive branch. It's independent. But the second is that it's comprised of both public members and attorneys, and that's specifically to prevent attorneys from stealing the show. Because neither, in the judgment of the founder, because neither of those groups deserve to hold sway, the Constitution further provides that neither public members nor attorney members can make the difference. Neither can constitute a majority in and of themselves. You have to have four votes to pass a name up. The tiebreaker has to be the Chief Justice. And the reasoning, I think, is that if anybody has to break a tie, we should be able to depend on our Chief Justice to adhere to the rule of law and to rule on a principled basis rather than on the basis of favoritism toward the bar or favoritism toward the public. That system has worked well because it forces both the public members and the lay members to work together. Both groups know that they don't control the majority. Their business is not to fight with each other, say, we have more votes than you, we can do a better job than you. They get together, listen carefully, and make a conscientious decision based on the merits of the judges. So that's the low number of votes the Chief Justice has had to make to break ties reflects that. And if you look at our judges, the judges that we currently have on the bench, the tremendous mix of prosecutors and defense attorneys, of women and men, of people from all sectors of society, you see that system is working well. From my experience, every time I've met with judges in other states, they always regard Alaska as having an exemplary system of selecting judges and have high regard for Alaska judges. Look at how many Alaska judges are chosen for appointment to federal judgeships. In the federal judgeships, you need the support to succeed and get confirmed. You need the support of the Senate. You need the support of your state legislative, your federal representatives to Congress, to the House of Representatives and the Senate. If you're the wrong party, you frequently get held up in confirmation in the federal system, just because it is a much more political appointment. But we have consistently had Alaska judges selected for appointment by the president and confirmed without any significant delay, despite the fact that they aren't in the same party as the president or in the same party as the confirming Senate vote that confirms them. Look at the history of Alaska judges in terms of judicial discipline, in terms of corruption, in terms of serious judicial problems. We have no history of scandals or serious problems. That's not to say that there aren't problems with some judges, and there aren't some judges who sometimes exceed bounds or reach decisions that seem to be improper. But we don't address that problem by a fundamental constitutional change that would open the door to a judiciary that really is selected by a completely different and structural method. I guess the last thing that I would say is I want to emphasize that I do think there's a tremendous need for additional public participation. It would tremendously help to have more people, more public members, more public groups contributing their views and participating in the process. But I think that can be done and can be structured. I think I'd also say I've never seen a situation in serving in the Judicial Council where the attorney members have tried to or been successful at dominating the public members. I served with Bill Gordon, with Eleanor Andrews, and with Tina Williams, and believe me, no lawyer could say anything that would intimidate them, and I think that's generally the case. I also serve on the Board of Governors of Bar Association now, and we have a very strong public membership, and I can tell you that the Bar Association does all it can to base all of its decisions on merit principles. Last, I want to say that enlarging the body of public members to increase the number of members serving would be logistically a tremendously difficult thing to do. Unlike many other public member sort of entities, the Judicial Council interviews require frequent travel to outlying locations, require a lot of time and effort to conduct interviews. I think it's going to be very difficult to find six members who are willing to do that. And if they do, they might bite off more than they can chew and might end up minimizing their participation. So I think just the sheer logistical problems of arranging schedules for that larger body of people, I think, will be a tremendous problem.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate your taking your time to give your testimony on that, Justice Briner.
Thank you for allowing me the opportunity.
Yeah. I do have several people lined up to testify, and I wanted to make sure that we gave time for them. I've got Elaine Andrews in Elaine Andrews in Anchorage, and then I'll go to Tana Williams in Ketchikan. So, Eileen, are you there? Or is Elaine? I'm sorry, Elaine.
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, please go ahead and give your testimony. Put your name on record.
Thanks for allowing me to testify today. My name is Elaine Andrews. I'm a retired Superior Court judge from Anchorage, and I was on the bench for more than 20 years, appointed first by Governor Hammond to the District Court, and then appointed to the Superior Court by Governor Hickel. I'm testifying as an individual and not on behalf of the courts or the bar or any other group. I am very much opposed to SJR 21, and I'd like to share with you my reasons. When I started law school, I remember one of my professors, when discussing judges and why lawyers should not be intimidated by judges, would say to the law students, just remember, the judge is a lawyer who is a friend of the governor. I really didn't understand what he was trying to tell me until many years later. I came to Alaska, and my first job was with the Judicial Council, and the job of the council then, as now, was the merit screening of judicial applicants as part of their core function. I guess I was naive enough at that time to believe that the judicial selection process was done that way across the nation. As a young lawyer working for the council, I was privy to the incredibly careful and thorough vetting that judicial applicants received by the public and law-trained council members. I then went on to work as an attorney in public and private practice and later applied to be a judge. Contrary to my law professor's belief, I was not a friend of Governor Hammond's. I was not a friend of Governor Hickel's. To be blunt, they didn't know me from a crow. But I was a judicial applicant referred to them as a merit-based candidate after careful vetting by the Judicial Council. By the way, I introduced myself to both governors long after my appointments to the bench. As a judge, I was the longest-serving judge member of the Judicial Conduct Commission. I served for 20 years on that body, and that is the body that hears complaints about judges and recommends discipline of judges to the Supreme Court. So I have the unique perspective of working for the council that screens judges, serving as a judge, and sitting in judgment on other judges. From that perspective, I can confidently say that we have been blessed with the finest judiciary in the country and that the merit selection process works because it is not driven by partisan politics. As a side note, I've been trained with other judges from other states over the years at the National College for the State Judiciary in Nevada. This organization provides continued professional education for state judges who attend from jurisdictions around the country. The judges from states who elect their judges spent the entire week of education chatting with other elected judges about election strategy. The judges who were political appointees were, to a disappointing degree, not judicial timber, as described by Alaska's founding fathers. We have a merit-based system that has given the state the best the legal profession has to offer. I have sat through testimony all day Friday, and I have sat through most of the testimony. I've sat through everyone who's testified here today, and I've read all the written testimony that's been submitted, and I'd like to address briefly a few of the concerns that have been raised. First, a concern that we need more public members because there's a lack of diversity on the council, with little to no rural representation. Specifically, that the attorney members are from some of the larger Alaskan communities. This can be both explained and alleviated. As to the attorneys, and actually all members of the council, the law requires that they not be state employees, so that they would not owe any allegiance to the governor by way of keeping their employment. Most lawyers who serve in rural Alaska are employed by the state as district attorneys or public defenders or assistant attorney generals. With few exceptions, private attorneys, like other professionals such as physicians or CPAs, cannot make an adequate living in small, isolated communities. Thus, the attorney pool is restricted due to the lack of private counsel working in rural Alaska and the toll it takes on a solo practitioner to be away from his or her practice for all the time that the council demands. As to the lay members, the governor is in charge of providing diversity by nominating public members. For more than 15 years, there has not been a public member from the Alaska community, rural communities off the road system. In earlier years, there were members from rural Alaska. The system does not need to be changed. The manner in which it is implemented may need more attention from those who justifiably seek a more diverse public input. Second, the Founding Fathers selected a merit selection system. Like other professions, such as medicine, the law is a profession that has a demanding level of professional knowledge. The Founding Fathers thought that public members could be valuable in the merit evaluation, but not given the deciding vote in a tie situation. The tie-breaking vote was given to the professional in the field, the Chief Justice. And keep in mind, the Chief Justice changes every 3 years, and the public members serve for 6. So you are already aware, having listened to the Judicial Council Director, of the infinitesimally small number of times that situation has occurred. I'm going to suggest a very imperfect analogy to try and get at what I'm talking about. I can't imagine as a society that we would want the majority of non-medically trained citizens on a hospital committee selecting the chief of surgery. We would want the most gifted of surgeons to be recommended to the hospital board to be chief of surgery, and surgeons are in the best position to know who in their profession is skilled, ethical, courageous, compassionate, who is up to date on the latest medical knowledge, who shares their skills with newly minted surgeons, who mentors others in the profession, and who will make the tough medical decisions that need to be made based on the best medical knowledge. Not hospital politics. If the lay members of the hospital committee outweighed the doctors 2-1 and voted against the doctors who were unanimous that the candidate that the public members favored was not the candidate who met the highest standards of the profession, I, for one, would not be making my next doctor's appointment with that doctor, regardless of the opinion of the public members. Judicial selection is not a popularity contest. It is not a political contest. It is a merit evaluation process. The governor is given a great deal of political sway in the process. He or she selects the public members. The governor gets to make a political selection among the most meritorious of the candidates. And keep in mind, in the extremely rare instances that the Chief Justice breaks a tie, that is a Chief Justice who was selected by the governor, elected by the people. The public is very involved in every step of the way through the public members on the council, solicitation of input from the public on all the candidates, public hearings where the public is invited, and if the candidates choose, the public can attend their interview with the council. There is no state in the country that gives its citizens more information on judicial candidates and judges than the state of Alaska. I am concerned that this bill is a not very well-veiled attempt by a narrow outside money interest to try and hijack the Alaska judiciary for its own purposes. In the recent past, outside money funded a lawsuit against the Judicial Council in federal court, claiming that the Judicial Council's selection and retention practices violated the federal Constitution. That lawsuit was thrown out in short order. This proposed constitutional amendment is essentially that lawsuit reformulated. I would look behind the curtain to see who is funding the lobbyists that are pushing it. From my personal perspective, I don't care whether the hijackers come from the left or if they come from the right. What I do care about is fair and impartial courts. Fair and impartial courts are made up of the best lawyers that can be found for each position. The council has always been able to deliver on the promise to give those names and those names only to the governor, who can select on any basis the governor chooses. I have been an Alaskan long enough and a judge long enough to see Democrat-dominated administrations and Republican-dominated administrations, but the courts have always remained outside partisan political battles, deciding election and redistricting cases and hot-button issues on the law without fear or favor. This legislation attempts to change that balance. Candidly, this is political court stacking, pure and simple. But the political winds blow in different directions over time, and those who act on their political advantage today by trying to upend one of the jewels of the Alaska Constitution may rue the day when the power shifts and the opposition tries to take the same unfair advantage.
Elaine, I've got several people lined up to testify. Can you wrap it up?
30 seconds left.
All right. Thank you.
And this proposed amendment throws the court into a political stew in violation of the wisdom of our constitutional drafters. I urge the committee members to follow their oath of office to uphold and defend the Constitution of the State of Alaska. This bill guts and politicizes judicial selection and retention, and neither upholds nor defends our Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you, Elaine. I appreciate you taking your time to testify. I'm going to have one more person testify today, and that is Michael Pauley, who has had a chance to come to Juneau to speak on it. And Tana, I'm sorry, I'm leaving stranded one, two, three, four, five, six people. And my intention at this point, obviously, I want to debate on the committee, so I'm going to have to hold it over till Wednesday. But I know that you're here, flew into Juneau, so I would appreciate taking the time for you to speak up. And for those on the phone, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Pauley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Michael Pauley. I'm here representing Alaska Family Action, which is the legislative advocacy arm of the Alaska Family Council. I'm going to truncate my remarks somewhat and deliver the full version in written form in light of the time situation we're facing. Our organization supports greater public involvement in the process by which we select, evaluate, and retain judges in Alaska. We support the goal of Senate Joint Resolution 21, which is to increase the public's decision-making authority in that process. If we look at other states, there's a wide variety in the number of persons who serve on judicial nominating commissions. Colorado and Arizona have nominating commissions consisting of 16 members each. Florida has 9, Utah has 8, Iowa and Oklahoma have 15, Tennessee has 17. So the proposal in the original SJR 21 for a 16-member judicial council is hardly radical or untried, and certainly the proposed committee substitute with a 10-member council is very mainstream as compared to other states. Having said that, from our perspective, the total number of council members is not the most important issue. What is important is the proportional representation on the panel between members who are there representing the interests of the State Bar Association versus those members who are representing the general public. Those who are enamored with the Judicial Council's existing structure argue that it's perfectly balanced with 3 attorneys and 3 public members. We disagree. The attorneys on the council are selected by the Board of Governors of the Bar Association, an entity with 4,212 members. They get to choose half the regular voting members of the council, and they constitute one half of 1% of the population of the state of Alaska. The 3 public members are there to represent non-attorneys, the other 731,000 Alaskans who are served by the court system. This, whatever you might call this system, it's not balanced. It shifts enormous power away from the general public and concentrates it in the hands of those who make a living practicing law in front of judges. Adding more public members will provide a valuable check on the ability of Bar Association members to vote as a block to prevent clearly qualified judicial applicants from being nominated for the governor's consideration. There have been four noteworthy examples in just the last 2 years where all three public members of the council voted yes to nominate a particular applicant for a judicial vacancy, but all three attorney members voted no. In each of these cases, the Supreme Court justice sided with the attorneys and voted no, thus defeating the nomination and shortening the list of nominees that would be sent to the governor. What is stunning is that three out of these tie-breaking votes occurred with respect to vacancies on the Supreme Court. To cite just one example, in June of 2012, the council met to consider a vacancy created when Justice Morgan Christen left the High Court. The council had to vote on a very distinguished group of 12 applicants. The pool of talent included one judge from the Alaska Court of Appeals, three judges from the Superior Court, one each in Fairbanks, Palmer, and Anchorage, and two administrative law judges, one from Anchorage and one from Juneau. Incredibly, not a single one of the candidates with previous judicial experience was nominated for the governor's consideration. Instead, out of this distinguished field of applicants, the council chose to nominate just two individuals. One was an attorney in private practice who also happened to be a member of the Board of Governors of the Bar Association. The other nominee was the former director of the Alaska Legal Services Corporation. Very few would doubt that both of these gentlemen possessed the qualifications to serve on the Alaska Supreme Court, but surely not to the exclusion of the many other qualified applicants with distinguished careers and prior judicial experience. Now, the Judicial Council will tell you that the scenario that I've just described here of split votes between attorney and public members is exceptionally rare. And that's true when you factor in the hundreds of votes over the years on district and superior court vacancies, which make up the bulk of the council's work. But when you apply it to only the state Supreme Court, it's not all that rare, especially in just the last 2 years. As we sit here today, two out of the five seats on Alaska Supreme Court were filled by a process where the attorney members and the Chief Justice voted as a block to overrule the unanimous choice of the public members and narrow the governor's options for filling those vacancies. And the public has no clue why this is the case, because, of course, all the deliberations occur in secret behind closed doors. One of the reasons we think SJR 21 is good public policy is that it will make those kind of tie votes much more rare, if not impossible. A larger commission with an odd number of regular voting members is much less likely, statistically speaking, to experience tie votes. We believe the most important words in the Alaska Constitution are found in Article 1, Section 2, which is titled Source of Government. It states, all political power is inherent in the people. All government originates with the people, is founded upon their will only, and is instituted solely for the good of the people as a whole. We believe that SJR 21 is a proposal that is consistent with this constitutional heritage, and we urge your support of this measure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. One of the, I appreciate that. Thank you. I've got five more minutes, so I'm going to go back to Tena Williams. Tena, did you hang on the line, stay online?
Hello.
Tena, I had called you and then found out that I had one person who had traveled to Juneau just to do this testimony. Are you still available to give us testimony?
Yes.
I've got the last 5 minutes of committee. You put yourself on record.
Okay. My name is Tena Williams.
Tena, sorry.
Yes, and I'd like to speak in opposition to a change in the makeup of the Alaska Judicial Council. I'm publisher of the Ketchikan Daily News, but what's more relevant is that I served on the council for 6 years, and I found that experience challenging and rewarding. Well, I made a lot of new friends and expanded my education as it pertained to the judicial system. And my dealings with council members and staff were just filled with grace and cordiality, common sense, and professionalism. And I highly respect all of those people that I worked with. And I was pretty dismayed when I saw SJR 21. And I'd like to address about 6 points, and I'm going to do it as briefly as I can.
Thank you.
First of all, I'd like to talk about council relationships. And as I said, my relationships with the other council members were great, and I think we had just the right number of people on the council for a number of reasons, including logistics. And if you add three more public members, there's going to be an imbalance. And with an imbalance in membership, you're going to risk creation of factions and divisions that really could derail the council's effectiveness, with consequences that I think would reverberate throughout the judicial system. In regard to council actions, despite what you've heard and what people fear, there are not major divisions between attorney members and public members. I never felt or believed that. The council acts most of the time with a great deal of agreement. We were all Alaskans first, and acting with the one mind that we wanted to nominate the very best people possible to serve Alaska as judges. And then when it came to voting, I want to make sure that you know that council members vote their own conscience on every applicant. We did not ever trade votes or create alliances. In my 6 years, it just never happened. I know legislators operate in a different environment, and that is sometimes necessary, but as the founders structured it, the Judicial Council is not political. With a six-member balanced board, everyone's free to act independently, and we did. And if there were to be an imbalance on the board with six members appointed by the executive, my fear is that the partisan politics would be brought into it. There would be pressure on them to vote a certain way because the executive would know they had a supermajority. And then the process would not be about an applicant's qualifications, but on their connections. And it would be would have a damaging effect on the quality of the state's judiciary, because the best applicants would not necessarily be nominated, only the best connected. And then in regard to the council's discussions and deliberations, the council's always acted very carefully and deliberately when it's making its decisions, in particular during the 6 years I served. And every council member got the opportunity to ask questions of each applicant, and after each interview, each member offered his or her thoughts on each applicant to the full council. And because there is a balance between the professionals and the public member, each member had an equal voice. And if there were to be an imbalance in the members, attorneys versus lay members, there's a huge risk that the discussion would be more stifled and that the others wouldn't bother to bring out their thoughts.
Tina, did you have you put this in writing by any chance?
I can get you a...
If you wouldn't mind, send it to the committee, because I've got the last 30 seconds. I wanted to give some heads up to the committee members.
Okay.
So if you could just wrap it up real quick, and then my apologies to all the people online.
Okay. Well, I'll just tell you that I'm just really opposed to changing the makeup of the council, and I think Elaine Andrews really summed it up well as to, and so did Alex Brenner, as to there may be some room for change, but this isn't the right way to do it.
All right, thank you. So my apologies to Justice Carpinetti, to Margaret Newman, Susan Orlansky, Meg Simonian. My apologies. I tried to keep things moving along. It's been true that most members of the Bar Association have now managed to take in probably most of the testimony on this, and I really want to have time for the debate on committee and give the sponsor time to make his case, I think, before the committee. So that will happen on Wednesday before we hear any other bill. All right? With that, we're adjourned.